I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Mitt Romney was in Bucks County yesterday rallying suburban Philadelphia supporters who have been prized voters this election season. Bill Clinton is making four stops in Pennsylvania today to cement support for President Obama, who won the state in 2008. Well, today on Radio Times, we're taking a final look at election 2012 before tomorrow's vote, and there is, believe it or not, still much to discuss. We want to talk about the impact of the Superstorm Sandy last week, the role of money and ads in the race, the power of battleground states, the media coverage, undecided voters, the gender gap, and other gaps as well. And we have two guests who have joined us. And joining us by telephone is Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. And Ross, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here, Marty. In fact, it's nice to be anywhere.
And well, and I don't even know where you are, Ross, but I'm glad you're on a phone and you have some electricity.
Right, in my office I do, at least.
Well, that's good. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Matthew Kerbel. He's a professor of political science at Villanova University. And Matthew, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Ross, assuming that you're up there in New Jersey, how much do you think Sandy has reconfigured the presidential race?
Well, I think that New Jersey is a blue enough state that even with the disruptions that that President Obama will carry it, and Senator Menendez, I think, will win pretty handily. There's a lot of confusion about polling, and there is a possibility that people will be allowed to vote anywhere on a provisional ballot. That is, people who've been displaced from their homes may be able to go into any polling station and say, look, you know, I lived in Long Branch and my house is gone, but now here I am in Nutley, and, you know, I will like to cast a provisional ballot, and I think they're going to allow that. But as far as which way the state will go, I think it will go to President Obama.
But maybe with lesser votes because of some of these obstacles and perhaps even some confusion?
Right. Yeah, I think so. No, I think the turnout will be reduced for sure.
How do you see Sandy? Well, I do want to move on to some other issues. It's kind of been the question du jour, but from your perspective, Matthew, do you think it has reconfigured the presidential race at all?
No, I think Russ is right, and I think if there is an effect, it probably won't be at the top of the ballot, but when you have this kind of disruption and people aren't really sure where to vote and you expect turnout to be down because of the storm, it's possible that there may be an effect down ballot, the congressional races and local races.
And Ross, that budding bromance between President Obama and Governor Christie, do you think that is short or will be short-lived?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that Governor Christie, who's a very canny fellow, knew which side his bread was buttered. And I think he made a guess that the president was going to win, and therefore it was kind of good to be on the right side of him, particularly as governor of a state that's going to need a massive amount of federal aid. And, of course, the situation in many ways stands in stark contrast to Governor Christie's position on the proper role of the federal government. But as they say, any port in a storm.
Any port in the storm, meaning that stuff doesn't matter so much.
I think that's right. The governor is ultimately the complete pragmatist.
Well, just picking up on that, and Matthew, going back to you, but I wonder whether what happened last week, especially in New Jersey and also in New York, does raise questions about how people think about the federal government, whether it's FEMA, what the government responsibility is under, you know, trying and emergency circumstances. Or do you think people are just, they have a more knee-jerk response, which is call FEMA?
No, I think that's certainly the case in the areas that were affected. And from a national perspective, if you pull back and see what this emergency looked like elsewhere in the country, I think it did enable President Obama in the final days of the campaign to talk about both the role of the federal government doing things that perhaps the private sector can't do, and to talk about pulling together and operating as a country, which, of course, harkens back to one of his earliest themes about there being no red states or blue states, just the United States, despite the fact that there's an awful lot of evidence to the contrary. Yes. In this campaign.
But do you think that's a message? I mean, this is only a couple of days before the election, but do you think that's a message that has resonated?
Well, I think it resonates with people who are feeling it. So certainly if you're caught up in the aftermath of the storm, it certainly does resonate. Whether it resonates the same way on a long-term basis outside of the immediate New York, New Jersey area, I think that's another question. But in terms of how to end the campaign, because the news agenda moved towards coverage of the storm and coverage of the president's response to the storm, it enabled the president to make his closing argument against a backdrop that was favorable to the message he's trying to communicate.
And that backdrop, of course, can be a president hugging somebody. I mean, that's a very powerful backdrop.
Especially when it's a bipartisan hug. Because we know that there's a lot of distaste in this country for the degree of partisanship that we've seen, and certainly the Christie hug doesn't change any of that, but symbolically, I think it does send a message of trying to reach across the aisle.
Ross, you've been involved and probably covered and talked about a lot of races. How does this stack up when it comes to things like rancor?
Did you just say rancor?
Rancor.
Oh, Well, it's you know, I think the precedent for rancorous campaigns was set a long time ago in American politics, and I think that there's this belief that somehow there was this golden age of gentlemanly politics in which the rules were set by the Marquess of Queensbury. But I think that in American politics, like, the rules have always been set by the Marquis de Sade.
Can we quote you on that?
You can quote me on that. By the way, I agree with Matthew's view. I think that for the people who were most affected, I think perhaps, you know, the president's presence and his you know, being right on the spot, being proactive, to use the term Governor Christie used, I think was important. And I think perhaps maybe the most important thing was he cast a very large shadow over Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was sort of nowhere during that time. I mean, he was out campaigning and so on, but I think a lot of the attention was being paid to what was happening in New Jersey and New York, and therefore it kind of gave the president a lot more face time.
But isn't that the advantage of being the actual commander-in-chief, which is you get to do something that actually potentially matters when there's a crisis, Ross?
Oh, I think that's right. I think it underscores, if not, you know, the importance of the federal government, certainly the preeminent position occupied by the president.
Matthew, going back to you, and I've heard others say, you know, this is the worst campaign that we've ever had in American history. It's never been so divisive. It's never had so much rancor, to use the word we're using this morning. Ross, of course, doesn't agree with that, but I'm curious about your perspective.
Well, it's the worst campaign since the last one, which was the worst campaign we've ever had. So, I mean, Ross is absolutely right. We have a very long history in this country of campaigns being nasty and sometimes extremely dirty. I think there's no question this was a nasty campaign, hard fought. I think it reflects the politics of the moment. And the politics of the moment, if you think about the demography of the moment, the way this country is changing demographically, if you look at the two coalitions that these two candidates have put together, the Romney coalition is largely white and older. The Obama coalition is multicultural and younger. And we're seeing the Obama coalition, just as a share of the population, grow in size each 4-year cycle. And that portends tremendous changes. I think those changes have already started. Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to imagine a period of such great transformation without enormous difficulty, and that's reflected in our politics.
But I wonder, too, if that's the demographic of the Republican Party, whether looking ahead they might be worried because we are a changing country demographically and in many other ways.
I think that's a very important point, Marty, and I think that's something that Republicans have to wrestle with because to the degree that Romney is trying to win this election with the white vote, and by getting enough white voters to the polls to be able to counterbalance the turnout that's expected among Latinos, African Americans, and others for the president. That's a strategy that becomes increasingly more difficult as we look forward to future election cycles. So this is certainly something the Republican Party needs to take into account going forward.
Ross, do you see those stark racial differences that Matthew does?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. You know, I, in the course of the campaign, I had come to the conclusion that we have a two-party system. We have the Democratic Party and the anti-Obama Party. And the anti-Obama Party is one, I think, that is, you know, overwhelmingly white and older, and you know, certainly extremely intense in their dislike for the president. I mean, even to the point of being susceptible to some rather bizarre conspiracy theories about him. But I think that you know, Matthew, in touching on the turnout question, has, you know, kind of put his finger on a very, very important thing, and that is that the Republicans on the whole are a high turnout party because of their demographic, because older people do tend to show up at the polls more reliably than younger people. You know, the Republican Party is the party of, you know, very solid white middle class, upper middle class, to some extent blue collar, you know, people who own electric lawnmowers, and, you know, whereas the Democrats have always been some party of the huddled masses, and it's hard to get the huddled masses out to the polls, or students out of their dorms, or single moms, you know, who have, you know, child care obligations and so on. It's tough. So they, you know, although the overall numbers for the future look much more auspicious for the Democrats, I think politicians tend to live in the present.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're individuals who can be very strategic about their own personal careers, but I think collectively the parties are just concerned about winning, this election.
Well, Matthew, Mitt Romney had a pretty sizable rally in Bucks County yesterday, and Bill Clinton is supposed to be, I think, at four places in Pennsylvania. Do you think Pennsylvania is in play?
Not really. I don't. I think that if Pennsylvania were in play, you would have seen both campaigns here. There would have been a tremendous presence here. You would have seen wall-to-wall advertisements. In short, we would have looked like Ohio. Or maybe for some listeners who can remember 4 years ago, when Pennsylvania really was one of the last states in play, the McCain campaign made a very big push here. It turned out that McCain lost it by a considerable margin.
Yes.
But Pennsylvania was really in play last time. This time, you're seeing the Romney campaign come here at the very last minute, and we're really not seeing statewide the kind of advertising that you would expect. You don't see, you do see Bill Clinton here, there's no question about that, but you don't see the president or the vice president here. So my suspicion is that the reason the Romney campaign came into Pennsylvania at the last minute is because they're looking at their Ohio polls, and they recognize that Ohio is problematic for them, and they're looking for another route to 270 electoral votes.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And it is, I promise, it's the last show we're going to do about the 2012 election before tomorrow's vote. We'll be back on Wednesday. Hope that's okay with you. Talking with Matthew Kerbel, professor of political science at Villanova University, author, co-author, editor of about eight books on mass media and politics, the presidency, elections, and political parties. Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, was scholar in residence in the office of Majority Leader Harry Reid, also has advised Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Medford Lees, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lees as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lees public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
I'm Dave Davies. Join me Monday at 1 for a WHYY original production, Beyond the Ballot. On the eve of the election, we'll consider Mitt Romney's chances of an upset in Pennsylvania and whether tales of Philadelphia voter fraud are real or imagined. We'll look at a spirited Senate race in Delaware, meet a member of the Electoral College, get a British perspective on the American political circus, and more. That's Beyond the Ballot, Monday afternoon at 1 on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Are you a breast cancer survivor? Do you have hot flashes? The Integrative Medicine Program at Penn Medicine is studying ways to improve the quality of life of breast cancer survivors. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of acupuncture or medication to treat hot flashes. Initial evaluations determine eligibility. To learn more about Penn's Integrative Medicine Program, 215-349-5647. 215-349-5647.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Matthew Kerbel and Ross Baker about some of their final thoughts and analysis of the 2012 election. This hard-fought race is going to cost billions of dollars, and it is being fought in a couple of counties and a couple of states. And we'd love to know what you think, your final thoughts and analysis of the 2012 election. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. 8477-WHYY. Ross, looking at the handful of states where this race, at least in the last couple of months or last 6 months, has been largely fought, even counties in those particular states, is that a good thing that so much of the race has been focused on sort of a handful of a small part of the country and sort of like a helicopter parent, whereas the rest of the country has been neglected, so to speak?
Well, it's really interesting you should say that, because on Saturday we fled New Jersey and came to Philadelphia, which looked like paradise to us.
And it is paradise, actually.
I know that. I grew up there. But we were in the hotel, and it was wonderful to see so much political advertising. We see some in New Jersey, but most of what we see, of course, is just endless Linda McMahon ads from Connecticut. I mean, it's just to the point of really making you want to gag. And then occasionally we'll see Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, who really doesn't have much competition. So to turn on local television in Philadelphia and see some real political ads was really great for a political scientist.
A revelation.
But, yeah, but it of course underscores the peculiarity of our electoral system and the electoral college, and the fact that in some states, you barely know a presidential election was happening, simply because the state itself has been written off by as belonging to one party or another, and so as a result of that, I think that that people very often feel a little bit excluded. But I mean, certainly the emphasis on Ohio is remarkable, and even as important as Ohio has been, I mean, there's a kind of a symbolism to Ohio beyond, I think it's the 18 electoral votes that they have, the fact that no Republican has ever won the White House without having carried Ohio. So, it becomes kind of like the city of Stalingrad in World War II.
Under siege. I don't know if they're laughing over there, but they've certainly had an eye and an earful. Matthew, going back to you, and this is, I think, a lesson that perhaps we relearn every 4 years, which is that we elect presidents by the Electoral College. There is the popular vote, but the focus is really the Electoral College.
That's exactly right. And that's why this election is really two separate elections. It's an election that's taking place in a handful of states, which is it's being fiercely contested. And then there's everyone else. And for everybody else, if you live in Wyoming or if you live in Vermont, you really don't have a sense that the election is going on, or you don't have a sense of the intensity of the election. I think it's also another reason why it's important when you look at the polling in this election and you look at the national polling. Remember, the national polling reflects all 50 states. The statewide polling, and in particular in those states that are tipping point states, that polling really should give you a better story of where the election stands, because it's all about the Electoral College.
Well, and I have to say, I would say pretty consistently, this is to you, Matthew, but Russ, I'd like to hear from you as well, which is when you look at the Electoral College votes, the president has consistently been ahead.
That's the unusual thing about this election, because it has been a close election the whole way.
Right.
There was a period of time right before the debates when the president had opened up a lead in the national polls of perhaps 5 points, and then a period briefly after the first debate when it appeared that the polls nationally were tied. The final polls going into tomorrow look more like the post-debate, first debate polls, which is to say very close, a point or two, but that still translates into a small but consistent, even stubborn lead for the president in states that he needs to win.
And Ross, are we seeing more polls now, or more daily polls, or more tracking polls, or more hourly polls? Are we just being, polled to death?
here's the rule, Marty.
Okay.
Many polls are good, more polls are better, too many polls are just right.
Like Goldilocks.
Right, exactly. Well, there are internal polls, of course, many of which never see the light of day. They're strictly tactical polls used by the campaigns themselves. And occasionally, results of those polls are leaked to the media because basically to serve the interests of the campaign for which they are undertaken. Then there are the polls by the media, then there are polls by independent polling organizations, Pew and Gallup and others, Rasmussen and so on. Some polls have a kind of, consistently Republican bias to them. Others have a somewhat Democratic bias to them. One of the things that I always do every day is go and see what the sage Nat Silver of the New York Times has to say on his blog, and it's really quite interesting because he never looks at a single poll. He'll look at a whole cluster of polls and try to make sense out of them. That's something I think people need to do. That a single poll. One by itself is practically meaningless.
Well, Ross, Matthew and I were talking about Nate Silver before the show began. And is he a sage that you look to as well, Matthew?
I don't know if I'd use the word sage, but I think his analysis is very interesting because he has a model. And the model is designed to take polling data, aggregate the polling data, and look at what the polling data is telling you collectively. Because Ross is exactly right. You don't want to look at a single poll all polls have error, and aggregated polls as well, but the error in any particular poll can be fairly large. In fact, one of the things that I think drives the media narrative is polling data, and one of the traps that many reporters fall into is latching onto individual polls, single polls, and then determining what the horse race story looks like based on that poll. And I think that's especially the case if it's a poll that was commissioned by the organization that the reporter works for. So I think by reading that kind of coverage, you may end up with a skewed sense of what the election looks like. If you do read Nate Silver, and he can be technical, right. I don't think he's for everyone, but what he's doing is he's trying to give you a sense of what this larger universe of polling is telling you. Now, he has a model. Models make assumptions, and assumptions can be wrong. But he's at least trying to give you a good faith estimate based on the data of what's going on out there.
Some have compared him to the Moneyball guy. I mean, the idea that you look at the sort of the unique features, I think, of a particular race or a particular candidate and then extrapolate from there.
Ross, isn't he a baseball guy, too?
I think he played poker for a while.
I think he also did baseball predictions.
Ross, you want to add to that? Then we'll get to our callers.
Skinny little guys with glasses were always baseball guys. But, it's interesting that one of the things that Nate Silver, I think, understands and I think has consistently talked about is the structural advantage that Democrats, particularly President Obama, has in this election, in that the Democrats are assured of winning three very large states, California, New York, and Illinois. The Republicans really only have one super big state, and that's Texas. So the base from which President Obama proceeds is much more auspicious for getting to 270 than the base that Governor Romney has. It takes a lot of Illinois to make one California. actually a lot of Idahos to make one California. So although that map looks very red, the redness is the result of a lot of states with 2, 3, 4 electoral votes.
And that's Ross Baker. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University. Also with us, Matthew Kribble, professor of political science at Villanova University. And we are talking about some of their final thoughts and analysis of the 2012 election with a focus on the presidential race. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Did you learn anything over the last year to year and a half? We'd be curious to hear from you. Let me see what Paul from Levittown has to say. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I'm just trying to figure out, when I hear these rallies for either Obama or for Romney, I hear very emotional cheering, people really committed, just yelling their hearts out for one or the other. I'm trying to figure out whether people vote on the basis of policy considerations, party, or if there's just some kind of gut feeling, some unconscious identification. And I want to add that myself, I have the used car test. Would I buy a used car from the candidate? And in my case, with Romney, Ryan, or Mike Fitzpatrick, I would not buy the car. But anyway, that's my question.
Okay, it's an interesting question. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Matthew, whether people vote on because they care about certain policy issues, or is it about feeling?
It's both. Some people will vote for particular policy issues. Some people are single-issue voters. They only vote on one issue that matters a lot to them. But there is a very important emotional component to voting. There's an identity component to voting. And I think that what the caller picked up at the rally is certainly people who would turn out to a rally or people who are going to be perhaps more drawn than the ordinary person to politics. They want to go out. They want to see the candidate, be in the presence of the candidate. And so that cheering that you hear, that emotional component, is certainly a reflection of what many people experience when they go to the polls. The question maybe would be, how do I feel about this candidate as opposed to what do I think about them?
So do facts matter, Ross?
Well, I think that, you know, in a sense, you know, when you hear cheering in a baseball game, you hear the cheering of baseball fans.
Yeah, right.
You know, people who enjoy tennis just don't go. And I think to a degree, I think that would surprise a lot of people. Party really does matter. You know, much is made of, you know, independent voters, but, you know, what we know about independent voters is most of them are not really truly independent. They kind of lean in one direction or another. You know, party is still a pretty good clue for people on how to vote.
Even though they complain bitterly about party and partisan politics.
Right. Well, one thing you can know pretty simply is whether you feel like a Democrat or a Republican. Where you may not know much about the candidate. This, of course, less true of the presidential election. Presidential election is just in a class by itself because we know so much about these guys.
Yeah.
By the time the campaign is over, the New York Times has written an article about their favorite breakfasts, and you know, we know about their kids and details of their lives that we don't know about the lives of our own relatives. So, you know, we can really, as voters, kind of make a judgment on, you know, whether I really like this guy. And you kind of add to that the party dimension. And then finally, you know, what policies are at stake? I mean, are you really concerned about the future of Medicare? Does it matter to you? And, you know, I think you've got a pretty good composite of what makes people vote.
Matthew, I'd be curious about how you have seen these undecided voters. One would assume that most people have decided the day before the actual election. But how, or maybe not. Maybe
some people don't decide until they go into the voting booth.
Really?
Well, they're not aware of it anyway. I mean, I think to a certain extent, people who say they're undecided may actually be leaning in one direction or another, but they haven't committed. So some of those people won't vote.
Right.
And the ones that do vote, some of them will make up their minds in the polling place.
Let me see what looks like Debbie from Glenside has to say. Debbie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm very concerned about the effect that the glitches I'm hearing about in voting booths and in just certain counties where there's all kinds of errors reportedly being made even already, and what effect this will have, do your guests think, on the election?
Well, I appreciate the call, Debbie, to Radio Times. And Ross, let me toss that at you. And I saw some photographs, I think yesterday in Florida and Sunday, people waiting 5, 6, 7, 8 hours to vote. Do we make it too hard to vote, even beyond Debbie's question about some of the outages and irregularities?
Oh, I think we do. And I think that for partisan reasons, people are having an even tougher time. I think, you know, the great controversy over the need to present a picture ID, a photo ID, I think is an indication of the fact that while everybody applauds and urges political participation and going to the polls and so on, clearly you want the people that you care about and the people that are likely to support you to show up and not necessarily the other guys. And, you know, you can also, of course, you know, inflate your turnout by, you know, there are rare instances of it, but you know, actually fraudulent voting. But I think that there are variations from state to state. That's something I think many people don't understand, that the Constitution really did give to the states enormously important role to play in determining the eligibility, length of residency, and so on. And that even though constitutionally 18-year-olds can vote, that a great deal of the of election law is state election law, not federal election law.
Well, and I wondered too, looking at the number of states, Matthew, that where there were these voter ID laws, Pennsylvania being one of them. Now, in Pennsylvania, that law has been upheld but postponed. But it's interesting that the courts largely have overturned these overturned these voter ID laws. An interesting sort of looking at the balance of power.
Oh, that's right. And that was the case certainly in Pennsylvania, where I think the outcome is still ambiguous. And there may be some confusion tomorrow when people go to the polls because of the way that the courts left it with the photo ID not a requirement for voting, right. But people will still be asked to show photo IDs. That certainly could cause confusion. We've seen other states, Ohio, Florida, for instance, where the courts have stepped in and overturned restrictions on voting. But there's no question about it that this is a state-by-state matter. Voting laws are state laws. So you have other places in the country, like Oregon, for instance, where everybody votes by mail, and they vote before Election Day. It's an extremely easy thing to do.
And in Pennsylvania, we have one day. I mean, you can vote absentee, but we have one day to show up.
We have one day to show up. We don't have any early voting here.
And picking up on that to you, Ross Baker, looking, I know millions of people have voted already, and does that tell us something about the electorate, or perhaps it tells us about how various states have various ways that people can vote?
Well, I mean, I think that there are people who really have taken advantage of it. I mean, certainly, I guess I've heard some estimates that as many as 35% of the votes cast will be early votes of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know how they come up with that figure, but certainly it's a trend that we're going to see increasing because what it means is you don't have to be, you know, in your home or in your precinct on Election Day. You can have cast your ballot and, you know, be a continent away and having registered your vote, which I think a lot of people find a very appealing idea.
Do you think that would actually happen in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Matthew?
I never make predictions about Pennsylvania.
We tend to be a little slow.
We haven't quite gotten there yet.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Ross Baker, joining us by telephone, professor of political science at Rutgers University, Matthew Kerbel, professor of political science at Villanova University. And it's our final show before the election tomorrow, the official election tomorrow. And we'd love to hear from you about what caught your eye or ear. What troubled you? What inspired you? Do give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. After this very short break, we'll be talking about all the money in this race. We're talking about several billion dollars. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Hill School supports WHYY. A private coeducational boarding school located in Pottstown, the Hill School provides students in grades 9 through 12 with the essentials for college, careers, and life in a diverse learning and living community. Hill students come from across the country and around the world. They are athletes, artists, friends, classmates, and future leaders. An open house is Saturday, November 10th at 9:30 a.m. Information is available at 610-326-1000 or online at thehill.org.
What kind of person would want to run for public office these days? Is it about them or their service to others? While there are many rewards that come with serving others, there are plenty of stressors like public scrutiny, criticism, less time for family, and less privacy. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, who's attracted to public service and what's at stake for them on a personal level? Today at noon here on WHYY-FM. Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Matthew Kerbel, a professor of political science at Villanova University, author, co-author, editor of 8 books on the mass media and politics, the presidency, elections, and political parties, kind of what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Also with us, Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He's advised both Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate, and was back in 2008 scholar in residence in the office of the Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate, Democratic Senator Harry Reid. And we have a bunch of calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. In fact, let me get Jay from Gladwin to join us. And Jay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask why you think that climate change was such an ignored issue in this campaign. I was very disappointed that it wasn't addressed or even discussed by the candidates.
And Jay, we did a show last week where we talked about 4 issues that we thought had been ignored in the campaign, and climate change was one of them. Let me begin with you, Matthew Kerbel. Was that just too hot to handle, to use a horrible metaphor?
Nobody wants to talk about climate change. I think people want to talk about climate change, but in the political class there's a tremendous reluctance to talk about climate change. And some of it, frankly, just speaks to the issue of money. And where some of the money comes from to fund campaigns. There are certainly interests, oil interests in particular, that are not interested in acknowledging this issue. And some of them have very deep pockets, and they spend a lot of money. And it's I think it makes it difficult for candidates of both parties to address this issue openly. I think it was a lost opportunity.
What do you think, Ross?
It's the threat that dare not speak its name. At least in presidential campaigns, there was Mitt Romney in Southern Ohio, coal country, talking about the fact that the president is anti-coal. And, the Democrats have lost the state that they once had in their pocket, West Virginia, over the coal issue. But it's broader than that, because I think it involves our driving habits. I think it involves the way we heat our homes. It's how much we're willing, what kinds of restrictions we're willing to accept to save the environment. It has always fascinated me, for example, why the same people who argue that we cannot pass the debt on to our grandchildren are willing to pass on a damaged environment to our grandchildren, which seems to me morally a far more repugnant prospect.
That's a fascinating way to think about it. Let me get, thanks for the call, Jay. Let me see what looks like Bo from Cape May County has to say. Bo, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm 81 years old. I have never felt that there is a more important election than the one we have now. There are many reasons. One, of course, is the Supreme Court. Whoever is the next president is going to set the agenda, the composition, and that is going to change the way our rights for the next foreseeable future. I hear Mitt Romney talk about his experience as a businessman. If his record as a businessman is something that we have to look forward to, and his record as a successful tax evader is anything that we can use to base his character on, seems to me that he's not the best choice, at least not in my mind. Nobody is perfect, but his record, his outlook, his reticence at providing information as to exactly what he would do, and all the other factors just add up to a non-starter, so far as I'm concerned.
Well, Bo, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Matthew, let me raise the first thing that he said about the Supreme Court and the importance, I guess the power, really, that a president has when it comes to naming people before the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think there's no question about it, although I think Bo may be somewhat unusual in terms of how important it is to his vote. But there's no question about it, because the president does get to nominate Supreme Court justices. The Senate has to confirm, but they usually do. And if you look at the composition of the Supreme Court, the conservative majority is getting older. And it's very likely that if Romney were to win the election tomorrow, he would be in a position to appoint younger conservative justices to fill enough of those seats to be able to really cement the conservative majority on the court for a generation or so. If Obama is reelected, it's not clear to me that anybody on the right is going to step down. But he would have the opportunity to cement the liberal bloc in the court, where you have Justice Ginsburg, for instance, getting a bit older.
Ross, let me throw something else out, and then we'll get back to our callers. And this is all the money that has been spent. I'm looking at an article. It's actually already a couple of weeks old, looking at both the Obama and Romney campaigns raising something more than $2 billion. And you throw in the parties, you put in the various individuals and organizations that are throwing money or investing money in this campaign. What do you think this says about our politics, that it is so driven by money?
Well, we are really a very ingenious people in terms of inventing delivery systems to get money into politics. There are contributions to individual campaigns, there are contributions to parties, there are contributions from parties to individual campaigns, there are political action committees, there are other organizations that are formed not under the rules of the Federal Election Commission, but under the rules of the Internal Revenue Service, the 527s, the 401 C3s and C4s. It's just the number of entities pumping money into the campaign on both sides is just remarkable. And I've always felt that other than disclosure, probably no other restraint on spending is feasible. I think that within 24 hours, any well-intentioned reform is going to be circumvented by some clever lawyer in Washington.
And that's been the track record. But it's interesting, Matthew, this is recession-proof. Much of the country's economy has been struggling over the last couple of years, but not when it comes to campaign contributions.
No, certainly not when it comes to large donor campaign contributions. Although I should also say that the Obama campaign has been very, very effective bringing in small contributions from large numbers of people. Now, one of the things that is interesting to me about that is the way the two campaigns are using money and how they have a different approach, really, to how they're going to spend the money. The Obama people are making a bet that grassroots efforts, social media, and really the kind of community organizing that Obama himself is well known for will be enough to overcome the effects of what in some states are massive ad spending. Not that the Democrats don't have massive ad spending in return, they do. But the Romney campaign is really placing its bet on large ad buys, particularly from outside groups. And one of the things I think that should be interesting to watch tomorrow is whether or not Obama made the right bet. Whether his bet that you can invest resources in a bottom-up grassroots mobilization effort, whether that's going to be effective enough to counteract the effects of large ad spending.
Well, and I wonder, Ross, whoever loses tomorrow, whether there will be, in a sense, buyer's remorse from those people that invested in those campaigns.
Well, there are people who hedge their bets and give to both. But I think that what you see, of course, is a situation in which the Obama people, I think, have made a very interesting decision that by offering, let's say, the $34 option when you're contacted by the campaign, Basically, you know, you're making a contact which is both, I mean, the $34 itself is trivial, but, you know, you're, in a sense, it's almost like a personal contact. It sort of makes the small donor feel part of the campaign, I think motivates people, and after all, the bottom line tomorrow is going to be turnout, and that's really what you want.
Well, Matthew, you wrote a book, I don't know how many years ago it was, called Netroots, Online Progressives and the Transformation of American Politics. And now it's all about Twitter, Facebook, and all the social media that's out there that is being used by all various players in the political campaigns.
Yeah, the social media world has progressed in the last few years since I wrote the book. But I think the basic approach is the same. It's the idea that the internet as a medium is quite different than television as a medium, in the sense that the internet is really a bottom-up medium, and it enables people to have person-to-person contacts, virtual contacts, but very often those contacts can be converted into real-world contacts. And if you look at that from the standpoint of the Obama campaign and the way they're trying to leverage those contacts by getting people out into the real world, by persuading voters, identifying voters, that's something that they used to great effect 4 years ago. Now, this year, levels of enthusiasm are widely reported to be much lower than they were. I think that's just one of the consequences of being an incumbent, not the challenger who was surrounded by that great prospect of hope and opportunity. But the question is whether or not this type of person-to-person model can be effective even in an environment like we have today where the race is much closer.
It'll be interesting to see. Let me see what Ron from Chester has to say. And Ron, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Undecided voters, I can't believe they really exist. They've had 18 months or more to decide, and I just can't believe at this point there's any people that don't know what they want to do.
Well, I hear some humor and frustration in your voice there, Ron. Let me see what Ross Baker has to say. Ross, how do you see undecided voters?
Well, I mean, I agree with what Matthew said before, which is there are people who really don't know what they're going to do until they go into the polls. I mean, you know, there are people who, for example, when they want to go to a restaurant, will go online and check out the menu, but they really don't know until they're sitting there and the hard copy menu is in front of them what they really want to eat.
Right.
I mean, the number is small, and, you know, my sense is of them that they're probably not terribly engaged. They feel there is a kind of civic duty to vote, and they do it more out of a sense of duty than a sense of enthusiasm, and they sort of make these impromptu decisions, which I think are rather astonishing when you given the amount of information that we know about these candidates.
Well, and does it also then help someone, and I think Romney's a very good example of this, when he was running in the primary, very conservative credentials, and he has clearly tacked to the middle. Ross, if someone is just paying attention now, they probably don't know about things that he said during the primary, for instance.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, I think how many people remember the $10,000 bet he made with Rick Perry? Which at the time created a huge furor over, you know, and underscored his enormous wealth and so on. And even more recently, the so-called 47% comment that he made at a fundraiser, I think has basically been kind of overwhelmed by Romney the moderate, and saying that he really does support reproductive rights for women and so on. Clearly, you know, the stimulus that's the most recent tends to be the most dominant.
Well, and it's interesting, Matthew, that Bill Clinton's going to be in Pennsylvania today, I believe, making four stops, and I think two of them or half of them in this part of the state. Does that raise questions, though, about President Obama and whether he's done an effective job, in a sense, touting what he has done over the last 4 years, whether you agree with it or not?
Well, I think Bill Clinton is just an incredibly effective salesman on behalf of Obama, and I think that's why he makes it such a terrific surrogate. And I think it also helps that Bill Clinton is extremely popular now in retirement. But I'd also like to pick up on something, if I could, that Ross just said about when people go to the polls, people are undecided and go to the polls. And some of them certainly do vote out of civic obligation. But I think you'll also see that a certain percentage of those people who are still undecided are not going to go to the polls.
Oh.
That sometimes people will tell pollsters that they're undecided because there's a certain desirability in saying you're going to vote. But some percentage of those folks, if they're really undecided at this point, probably are not going to vote.
Let me see what Jim from Clarksboro has to say. Jim, go ahead. You're on radio. What?
Yes, thanks for taking my call,
Marty. Okay, Jim, go ahead.
Wonder if your guest could comment on why the president has not reminded the electorate that the primary stated goal of the Republican House was to get Obama unelected. All of this was secondary, and they have the election record, they've set it accordingly.
Well, Jim, let me see what Ross Baker says about that. Ross, what do you think?
Well, of course, you know, there was the memorable statement by Minority Leader Mitch McConnell that his objective in the 112th Congress was to defeat President Obama. And the Republicans have made no bones about it. And I think the frankness of it and the starkness of the statement, I think, shocked a lot of people. But after all, what is it all about? You know, as Senator Ingalls of Kansas once said, you know, the difference, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans were like Grant and Lee fighting it out in the wilderness.
And what a wilderness it is. Indeed. And speaking of the wilderness, Matthew, we only have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye here. And the media is a large animal. But how would you describe the media coverage?
Unfortunate. And I say that because you go back just a couple of minutes to what we were talking about some of the things that happened earlier in this campaign, that happened when people were not perhaps paying as much attention as they are now. It's remarkable, isn't it, how quickly things are forgotten, how we seem to move from episode to episode without a real sense of continuity across these episodes. And I think there's been so much attention to the horse race. This is not a new thing. But there's so much attention to the polling and the question of who's going to win that we don't have an opportunity to go into any great detail on substantive matters. I think that this is a very important election, as others have said. And it's an election where you really have different visions of the country. I think media coverage really didn't play to that and didn't really raise questions about what those visions are.
Ross, I'm giving you the last 30 seconds. Go ahead.
No, I think a lot of it's been about horse race all along during the primaries and during the general election. I think that, you know, people want to know who's ahead, who's behind, or at least that's the feeling among the people who are reporting, and that's what they give the public.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ross Baker, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Marty.
And one day we will meet in person, right?
That's right. I'm going to come down to Philadelphia. We're going to have lunch.
There you go. Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He's been a guest for 25 years on Radio Times, and I've never met the guy. Matthew Kerbel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's Professor of Political Science at Villanova University. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to learn about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, lots of social media there. And you can also send us an email and find out about Sirius satellite radio. Lots of good stuff there for you. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. We welcome Emily Bryant back to Radio Times today. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.